from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, just in time to be way too late, here are my two cents on the debate. Two personalities, pretty indistinguishable in some ways. One clearly on the offense. One sort of laid back, a little cool perhaps. Nonetheless, I'm going to give my vote. I think it's Mariah over Nikki in the American Idol. Oh, yes. All right, the presidential debate. Let me explain first that being here in London, which I am, I saw the debate online via C-SPAN. Thank you very much, Cable Systems of America, at on Thursday morning. I'd already been told by a friend in America, a guy who's never liked Obama, that the president had done a lousy job in the debate. So I was set up in that way. To be fair, and because I had to make breakfast, I watched half the debate and listened to half of it. Kind of intermixed, but still. Now, given the incredible constraints of the system, the lovely system we live under, in which two parties have to raise $1 billion each from a limited group of likely prospects, I thought both guys, did a respectable job of making their case, also given the fact that Obama was on defense and Romney was on offense. But it also struck me, looking at the wave of negative commentary about the president in the aftermath, that he may have desisted from attacking Romney more forcefully because his handlers and maybe even his own internal political calculator told him, "Mr. President, your big electoral edge, according to the polls, is with women. Women don't like aggressive, angry politicians. So, be the cool Obama." Which reminds me, when have public opinion polls done anything to serve, you should pardon the expression, the public? They do help politicians to pander more precisely, which helps the public to become even more cynical and jaded about the political class, so that might be counted as a plus. And by the way, pollsters these days tend to call it dinner time, which, wackily enough, is exactly when telemarketers tend to call, which might explain why major poll response rates have been hovering in the mid-20% range. Last time I checked. That means it wouldn't take very many more of us to de-participate to render them useless even by their own standards of mathematical rigor. Me, I can't for the life of me understand why anybody would walk into a voting booth, pull the curtain, cast a secret ballot, and then walk out and tell a total stranger how they voted. Fortunately, the networks have announced they're cutting back on exit polling this year, and for the very best of reasons. It's too expensive. We can't do very much, ladies and gentlemen, to change the rest of this bizarre political system we have now, but we could possibly lessen its addiction to polls by making them appear more worthless than they already are. By the way, having been living deep in the recesses of Richard Nixon's White House tapes for the past few months, I can tell you, on at least that evidence, the presidents who most vehemently deny in public paying attention to polls most slavishly follow them in private. Big surprise. We could at least deny them that pleasure. Hello, welcome to the show.
Apocalipse de meros hips com um falso alarme. Economistas, médicos, políticos apenas nos tratavam com escárnio. Nossas visões se revelaram válidas e eles se calaram mais à tarde. As noites estão ficando meio cálidas e um mato grosso em chamas longe arde. O verde em cinza se converte logo, logo. É fogo,
é fogo,
é fogo. Éramos uns poetas loucos místicos, éramos tudo que não era ação. Agora são contados estatísticos os cientistas que nos dão razão. De que valeu em suma a lógica do máximo consumo de hoje em dia. De um
a Bárbara, marcha tecnológica e da fé cega na tecnologia. Há só um sentimento que é de dó e de maluco. É fogo,
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 é fogo.
Doce morada, bela, rica e única, dilapidada só como se fosses a mina da fortuna econômica, a fonte eterna de energias fósseis. O que será com mais alguns graus Celsius de um rio, uma Bahia ou um Recife? Ou um ilhéu ao léu clamando aos céus se os mares subirem muito em Tenerife? E dos sem água, o que será de cada súplica, de cada roubo? É fogo,
é fogo,
é fogo. Antártida, deixamos nossa marca no planeta. Aliviemos já a pior parte da tragédia anunciada com trombeta. O estrago vai ser pago pela gente toda. É foda,
é fogo,
é fogo,
é fogo,
é fogo,
é fogo,
é
fogo.
É vida em jogo. É foda,
é fogo,
é fogo,
é fogo.
From Leicester Square. Remember him in London, England? I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome. Where the shadows are lengthening, it's a cool autumnal evening in London, England. And I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of the show. And now, speaking of cool, news of the warm, won't you? See? We did a 180.
Soft, listen to the warm.
Or at least a 160. Climate change is already contributing to the deaths of more than 400,000 people a year and costing the world more than $1.2 trillion, wiping 1.5% annually from global GDP, according to a new study reported in the Guardian newspaper. The impacts are being felt most keenly in developing countries, NACH, where damage to agricultural production from extreme weather linked to climate change is contributing to deaths from malnutrition, poverty, and their associated diseases. Air pollution caused by the use of fossil fuels is also separately contributing to the deaths of at least 4.5 million people a year, the report found. The 331-page study entitled Climate Vulnerability Monitor, a guide to the cold calculus of a hot planet, was carried out by the DARA, D-A-R-A group, a non-governmental organization based in Europe, and the Climate Vulnerable Forum, written by more than 50 scientists, economists, and policy experts commissioned by 20 governments. Wish it said what kind of scientists. I'm growing tired of that. Scientists. Yeah, he's a paleontologist and he knows a lot about climate. By 2030, the researchers estimate the cost of climate change and air pollution combined will rise to 3.2% of global GDP, with the world's least developed countries suffering losses of up to 11% of their GDP. The Prime Minister of Bangladesh, you know him, Sheikh Hasina, said a one degree Celsius rise in temperature is associated with 10% productivity loss in farming. It means for us losing about 4 million tons of food grain, amounting to about $2.5 billion. This is about 2% of our GDP. Major economies, though, will also take a hit as extremes of weather and the associated damage, droughts, floods, and more severe storms, could wipe 2% of the GDP of the U.S. by 2030, while similar effects could cost China $1.2 trillion by the same date. While many governments have taken the view that climate change is a long-term problem, there's a growing body of opinion that the effects are already being felt. Scientists have been alarmed by the increasingly rapid melting of Arctic sea ice, which reached a new record minimum this year. We reported that to you earlier. The European Union's climate chief, Connie Hedegaard, warns extreme weather is becoming more common as the effects of climate change take hold. Climate change and weather extremes are not about a distant future. Formerly one-off extreme weather episodes seem to be becoming the new normal. Thursdays on NBC. Oh, it's not about that. All right. Anyway, that's that report. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Do it the way you will. It reminds me, I mentioned, I think on last week's broadcast, apropos of New Orleans and the Corps of Engineers and blah, 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 Rob Virchik at Loyola University in New Orleans wrote a book a couple years ago called Facing Catastrophe. And one of the main points in the book is that one reason we're so apparently, and by we I mean you, blasé about losing stuff, you know, as these reports predict, is because we have no way of putting a dollar value on the services provided by nature. And so when outfits like the Army Corps of Engineers, just to pick one, does a so-called cost-benefit ratio, they can never calculate in the benefit of not losing a value to us, like the buffering from hurricane ferocity that coastal wetlands provide in Louisiana, just for an example. So why did I bring that up? I don't know. Because I'm sitting here with an open mic. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your brain on the war on drugs from the Boston Globe. State, that would be Massachusetts, state drug lab chemist Annie Dukin labeled the vials as containing THC, the active ingredient in marijuana. But when another chemist ran the vials through a machine to confirm her analysis, one had little THC, the other was mixed with two other drugs. The second chemist sent the vials back to Dukin to resolve the discrepancies, asking her to repeat the screening test. When she resubmitted them, the machine showed the vials contained pure THC. This incident, detailed in a 100-page Massachusetts State Police report obtained by the Globe last week, illustrates one of the many ways in which she, state drug lab chemist Annie Dukin, was able to circumvent safeguards intended to ensure that drug evidence is properly handled and analyzed by workers in a now-closed lab formerly run by the Massachusetts State Department of Health. Forensics specialists say the lab's procedures appear to have been fairly standard, but they were still not enough to prevent an ambitious chemist's rampant breaches of lab protocol, apparently to boost her performance record. In the process, investigators say she has jeopardized the reliability of drug evidence used in 34,000 cases during her nine-year career. The 34-year-old chemist was arrested Friday and charged with two counts of obstruction of justice and one of falsifying her academic record, allegedly lying under oath about having a master's degree in chemistry. I got one of those. That's no big deal. She was dry labbing her screening tests. That is to say, putting a dry Labrador Put simply, she was skipping a critical first step, according to her admission to investigators, and instead often made a preliminary investigation of drugs simply by how they looked and by the type of suspected drug that was checked off on a control card that accompanied the sample. Typical lab protocols require an initial screening test called a color test, in which a chemist applies a specific liquid to each drug sample to determine its identity by the color it turns. That's how I determine my identity each day. Wet myself and see what color I turn. While colleagues were suspicious of her shoddy work habits and unusually high output and reported concerns to supervisors, little action was taken for more than a year, according to the police inquiry. This is Annie Dukin's brain on the war on drugs. And the new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen, foreclosure. You may recall Eve Smith on this program a couple of years ago now. Yeah. Many of the things she said then now being found by judges as these cases lumber onto trial. Dateline New York, something scary has been haunting a homeowner facing foreclosure in Brooklyn. According to Reuters, a living dead bank that a judge compared to Dracula in a decision this week involving an apparent case of robo-signing. Justice Arthur Schack questioned how the failed financial institution IndyMac Federal Bank could have initiated a foreclosure on a half million dollar mortgage when the bank ceased to legally exist 3 weeks before it filed the foreclosure. For IndyMac to have standing to foreclose on homeowner Mendel Meisel's property would be the legal equivalent of a vampire, the living dead, the judge said. The judge is a frequent critic of mortgage servicing abuses. He also chastised the law firm that brought the action, Fine Such and Crane. The firm faces possible sanctions from Schack for, quote, engaging in frivolous conduct. Don't you be doing that now. Leave that to the civilians. Schack compared the law firm, Judge Schack, Justice Schack, compared the law firm, Fine Such, to Dracula's servant Renfield in the 1931 film. Similar to Renfield throughout its papers and at oral argument, they demonstrated their loyalty by not betraying its client and master, the living dead IndyMac, Schack wrote. There was also lack of proper documentation against the charges amidst the changes at IndyMac. It went bust in March 2009. Lawyers at Fine Such filed the foreclosure case. The justice said IndyMac ceased to exist at that point and was unable to be named as a party in the lawsuit. He cited a 2009 opinion which said that after a merger, the acquired bank ceases to exist and can't be named as a party in litigation. That seems fair. The judge also faulted the numerous defects in how the mortgage and note were assigned to IndyMac by MERS. Eve Smith was the first to tell us about MERS, Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, the privately held electronic mortgage registry set up by banks to, among other things, avoid having to pay those pesky transfer fees when they transfer real estate from one trust account to another, thereby depriving counties around the country of millions of dollars. Even if IndyMac had existed, the law firm did not present documents authorizing MERS to assign the mortgage and note to the bank, the judge said. The assigner for MERS was a robo-signer, a bank official who signed off on foreclosure documents without ever reading them. Same way I sign my checks. News of the F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen. And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dialing up an apology here from Alan Jones, who is the Australian equivalent, I guess, to either Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck. He's on the, as they call it, talk back. We call it talk radio for about 3 hours a day. And said recently, this past week, I guess, that Prime Minister Julia Gillard's father, who had just died, had died of shame because of her lies. Cute. There was an uproar. And here's Alan Jones.
I'll just make one or two very simple and straightforward points to start with, and then you'll be free to ask what you want. Can I just say this, that there are days when you just have to concede and man up and say, you got it wrong. And on this instance, these are remarks which I shouldn't have repeated. To repeat them was wrong. To even offer any impression that I might seek to diminish the grief that a daughter would feel for her father, independently of who that daughter might be, is unacceptable. I had a very close affiliation with my father, and I know the kind of grief that attends that person's passing. Of course, I didn't intend to do this, but that's irrelevant. What is relevant is it may have sought to diminish the grief that a daughter felt for a father. That is unacceptable. To that extent, any comment that might lead to that feeling by the daughter is unacceptable. And there's no other way of putting it. You just have to make that honest observation. And I was taught as a young kid by my father that if you're going to eat crow, you should eat it while it's hot. And therefore, I felt that this matter should be addressed today. And so, in the light of that, I repeat, the comments were, in the light of everything, unacceptable. They merit an apology from me, and you've just got to be big enough to admit that you got it wrong, it shouldn't have been said, no matter who it is. The fact that it's the Prime Minister, I suppose, adds an extra dimension to it, but I think any daughter, you'd actually come to the same conclusion.
Get on with it.
Because it may well be that those sentiments sought to dilute the grief that a daughter feels, and I'm now very mindful of that. As I said, the comments shouldn't have been repeated. They were. I don't regret that. I apologise for it. It's more than regret.
Yep.
I could have expressed that in a sentence in a press release, and I didn't. I'm simply, through you, apologising for those statements being made. And
okay, all right, thank you. Alan Jones, Australia talk radio host, who clearly knows how to fill 3 hours a day. Clearly. Thierry Guillet, the French fashion designer and founder of the Zadig & Voltaire label, I don't know what that is, has apologized for saying that Chinese tourists won't be welcome at his new luxury hotel in Paris. That's cute. That is cute. Guillet, in an interview with Women's Wear Daily, had said his hotel will be selective with its choice of guests. It won't be open to Chinese tourists, for example, he said. There is a lot of demand in Paris. Many people are looking for quiet hotels with a certain privacy. French newspaper Libération said Guillet later asked the magazine to change his quotation from, quote, Chinese tourists to, quote, busloads of tourists. In a statement released later, Guillet apologized and said he'd wanted to emphasize that the hotel wouldn't be for the mass tourism market. My remarks were doubtless clumsy. I understood they might have heard my friends from China, France, or elsewhere, and I'm deeply sorry for that, he said, according to Agence France-Presse. Daylight Salt Lake City police there say they raided the wrong house Wednesday while executing a no-knock search warrant. These things never happen, do they? Police Chief Chris Burbank held a news conference Friday to discuss the raid. He said officers made a mistake and had the wrong address while serving the warrant during a narcotics raid with DEA officers. Our Joint Narcotics Task Force served a search warrant on there at this address. In fact, it was the wrong address. A 76-year-old woman was inside the home and police broke down her front door with guns drawn. It's something that has not happened in the police department that I know of, said Chief Burbank. It's something that we just don't experience. It's an unacceptable mistake. He said he sat with the woman and her family the following morning and apologized, adding the police department would fix the damage that occurred during the raid. Neighbors in the area say they were shocked to see police at the woman's home and even more surprised to later find out it was a police mistake. They should have done more homework in the situation and thoroughly checked out their sources instead of just hitting an elderly lady's home, said one neighbor. Yes, they should have. You be the police chief, buddy. The founder of the Free Gaza movement, which uses flotillas in trying to break Israel's blockade of Gaza, tweeted that Zionists were responsible for the Holocaust and has now apologized. Greta Berlin, interesting choice of names, tweeted that she meant to post the tweet to her private Facebook account rather than the organization's Twitter account. Ah, I see. A former high school student who had only his name and the word fag printed beside his 1970 yearbook picture says the North Vancouver School District, this is in Canada, has agreed to apologize personally to him over the incident. Robin Tomlin said that as he waits for a liver transplant, he's gratified to finally have the school recognize the hurt he suffered long ago. When you're sick and you're old and you've got your bucket list and you cross that one off, he said, I wanted to get a message out to the kids that you can stand up for yourself. Tomlin said someone from the school board phoned him this week with the news after he rejected as insufficient an earlier email from the board expressing regret over the incident. The school district's communication manager in an email did not confirm that an apology would be issued. Just dangling it out there, like the liver itself. Swedish furniture giant IKEA has apologized for removing all the women from their Saudi Arabian catalog following public outrage in Sweden, including the European Union minister slamming the action as medieval. In the Saudi version of IKEA's annual furniture booklet, all the women who appear in the catalog published in other countries have been removed via photo retouching, and all the furniture has been renamed Ibn. The altered images caused a stir when revealed in Swedish media, prompting an apology from IKEA's head office in Sweden. We apologize and understand that people are upset, said Ulrika Engelsson Sandman, a spokeswoman for IKEA. This is really unfortunate. We've been in contact with Saudi Arabia to discuss this issue. It should be possible to balance IKEA's values so that we don't discriminate against people. At the same time, we try to adapt to the cultures and the legislation that are there. The removal of the women, including a young girl who was studying at her desk in the picture, has prompted a strong response from many women, many prominent women in Sweden. Elsewhere around the world, in apologies, the Iranian news agency apologized, quote, to all our viewers, no, the television service, quote, would like to apologize to all our dear viewers for the mistaken release of a fake opinion poll on our website. Unfortunately, an incorrect item was released on our website, which included a fake opinion poll on popularity rate of President Ahmadinejad and U.S. President Obama. The news item was extracted from the satirical magazine The Onion by mistake, and it was taken down from our site in less than 2 hours. We offer our formal apologies for that mistake, said the editor-in-chief of the Iranian English service in almost good English. Lots of service. KitchenAid. The home appliance brand was forced to apologize for a mix-up by an employee who sent an anti-Obama tweet from the official account. The tweet read, Obama's grandmother even knew it was going to be bad. She died 3 days before he became president. This guy should meet Alan Jones. Obama, of course, referenced his grandmother during Wednesday night's debate. The tweet has since been deleted from the account, and the brand later tweeted out a multi-tweet apology. And finally, Apple Chief Executive Officer Tim Cook has apologized for the faulty Apple Maps app and suggested that users turn to rivals Microsoft, Google, and Nokia. The letter published last Friday states that everyone at Apple is, quote, extremely sorry for, quote, the frustration that the new software is causing. Apple's employees are working, quote, nonstop to turn around the maps. All I want to know is where the hell I am. See, I don't ask much. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news from outside the bubble. And this involves somebody you've never heard of, if you're living in the United States. But I can stop the music for a minute. No, I won't. And just say that this is a scandal, finally, that I can weigh in on personally. Because way back when I was starting in radio, it was at a station, played a lot of rock and roll. And there were a lot of rock and roll DJs there. And the audience was, you know, kids. Kids used to listen to rock and roll, I know. Sounds hard to believe. And there was one DJ there who used to brag about, I'm going to be real delicate about this now, having some young female listeners, admitted to the station through the lax security door, and having them, going to be delicate now, service him under the console, if you get my drift. So, with that in mind, here we have Jimmy Savile. Sir Jimmy Savile died last year. Very popular host of television programs aimed at kids. Guess what? It was this from The Independent today in London. It was an open, dirty secret, say some. Regardless of who knew, almost nobody actually did or even said anything about it. The BBC is mired in sordid allegations surrounding Jimmy Savile. It faces a crisis that threatens to provoke an uproar that it may not be able to solve. The corporation has until now denied it knew about any misbehavior and said it had not received any complaints about Savile's behavior. But in less than 2 weeks since the independent television network ITV screened a documentary detailing in some detail allegations that he abused young girl fans. More than 40 of the presenter's alleged victims have contacted police to claim they were molested by the DJ and TV personality. The fallout has destroyed the reputation of the presenter of Jim'll Fix It, who raised money for charities by regularly running marathons. It has also embroiled the BBC in claims that Savile's assistants lined up young girls to visit him in his dressing room. You know, like procurers. One national newspaper has alleged that, very fact, a woman has claimed she was raped by the procurer on BBC premises. The corporation was already reeling from the accusation that women were assaulted by Savile, as well as Gary Glitter. Would you stop playing that song now at sporting events, please? The Fuhrer continues this weekend as a former Radio 1 DJ, that's the BBC's main rock and roll radio station, shed light on the culture that prevailed at the BBC. Liz Kershaw said she was routinely groped by another presenter as she was broadcasting, much like the guy I knew serviced under the console, on the air, adding to the belief that there was a culture of such behavior at the organization, Radio 1. She described the atmosphere at the station as intimidating and said that when she tried to complain, she was asked if she were a lesbian. She still works for the BBC, now for its Six Music radio station. And she said at that point, when she went there in 1987, Jimmy Savile's behavior, he was then at Radio 1, was an open secret. The rumors there were there, the jokes were there, it was an open secret. Around Radio 1, everyone joked about Jimmy Savile and young girls. It was like walking into a rugby club locker room, she says, of the atmosphere there, and it was very intimidating for a young woman. There was one presenter who routinely groped me. I would be sitting in the studio with my headphones on, my back to the studio door, live on air, and couldn't hear a thing except what was in my headphones, much like me, ow, but now. And then I'd find these wandering hands up my jumper, British for sweater. I couldn't say anything, I couldn't even explain, because I was broadcasting to the nation. The BBC's, at least four women say they were molested by Sir Jimmy Savile at a school, Duncroft, in Staines. That's a community. And that's a school for girls. The Metropolitan Police Force is leading an assessment into the allegations. And the Times of London, in addition, says charities that were named after Jimmy Savile are now trying to get his name removed from their charities, finding it a bit unseemly, don't you know? News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, the copyrighted feature of this broadcast, but on a somewhat related topic, while we're misusing youngsters, this from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You heard about this a few years ago on this broadcast. Now it's a documentary. Deaf boys sent by their parents to a Catholic boarding school in Wisconsin where they were molested again and again by a popular priest who stalked them in their dorm rooms at night on trips to his Northwoods cabin, even in the confessional. Described as mentally retarded, they were often not believed or worse, ignored for years by the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, police, prosecutors, and the media. This is the late Father Lawrence Murphy. A couple of the victims, Gary Smith and Arthur Budzinski, are reaching a new and potentially wider audience with the release of a documentary by Alex Gibney. It will be showing in London here, I think, soon. It debuted at the Milwaukee Film Festival. Murphy worked at St. John's School for the Deaf from 1950 to 1974, is believed to have molested as many as 200 deaf boys before his death about 14 years ago. Bishops had known about the abuse for decades but did not move to defrock him until he was near death. Well, you can watch the documentary. Probably a good thing to do. But in the meantime, you can listen to the song.
Boom, boom. One or two deaf boys,
boom, boom,
in the next room,
boom, boom.
Now they're in the closet,
boom, boom.
Between me and the broom,
boom, boom.
Half a dozen deaf boys,
boom, boom.
Nice little crowd,
boom, boom.
They can be quiet,
boom, boom.
And I can be loud,
boom, boom.
24 deaf boys,
boom,
take me all day,
boom, boom.
Barely got the time to,
boom, boom.
Eat and to pray,
boom, boom.
Deaf boys can't hear me coming. Deaf boys, don't you dare call its mumming. Might be a chink in my priestly poise, but how can I resist?
How can deaf I resist?
Boys? Half a hundred
boom,
deaf boys,
boom, boom,
who got a head of steam,
boom, boom.
I could be their coach,
boom, boom.
They could be the team,
boom, boom.
88 deaf boys,
boom, boom.
One for each key,
on the piano of my longing. They play a hushed melody. 150 deaf boys. Oh, this could get tight. A few dozen in the morning, and all the rest at night. Deaf boys can't hear me coming. Deaf boys got my heartstrings a-strumming. Make me make such a joyful noise. Just can't get enough.
Just can't get enough.
Now if I had a deaf boy for each day of the year, 365, oh, that would be dear. How many deaf boys have there actually been? Why not ask how many dance on the head of a pin? The world is full of deaf boys, and I'm only one man. All that God expects is, do all that you can. Deaf boys can't hear me coming. Deaf boys got me hymning and humming. A shepherd with a closet full of toys. Let's hear it for those deaf for boys.
This is Le Show from London.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are proud to present Let Us Try, a ballad of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Let us try to stem the tide.
Well, it's not just New Orleans where the Corps of Engineers builds things that they think are going to, or they say are going to be good for business, and then something happens. The federal government spent more than $100 million to build and maintain locks on the Chattahoochee River in Georgia. This is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. To handle fleets of commercial barges bearing supplies back and forth and millions more to deepen the river system for the boats. But the flotillas of vessels floating to Columbus never materialized.
Let us try.
While those that did ply the river caused tension with some Atlantic politicians and complicated Georgia's fight with its neighbors over water rights. Now the prospect of barges powering upstream into Georgia's river towns could be dashed for good, because in a money-saving move, the Army Corps of Engineers plans to stop manning the decades-old network of locks to lift or lower the big boats so they continue along the river. The locks will operate on an appointment-only basis. Hello, Mr. Locke. Disruption of commerce won't be an immediate problem. The locks haven't seen a commercial vessel pass through in 3 years. Columbus hasn't handled a barge since 2000. Watchdog groups said it costs as much as $20 million a year to maintain the channels, a frequent target of environmental advocates and fiscal analysts. The commercial route was also a flashpoint among Atlanta politicians, since they said the water flow needed to keep the shipping route open strained Atlanta's main drinking water source, Lake Lanier. Commercial traffic on the Chattahoochee never came close to meeting the 1.8 million tons of commercial activity the Corps once predicted for the route, the bulk of which was fertilizer and agricultural products. Shipping traffic steadily declined to virtually nothing by 2006. By then, much of the traffic that was moved along the river was sand and gravel dredged from the system itself. Let us try, ladies and gentlemen. Let us effing try. Now, news of AFPAC. The Obama, this, along with the revocation of the terrorist designation for the MEK group that I talked about on this program a couple weeks ago, just shows you how malleable this terrorism thing really is. How kind of fluid and dynamic it is. Oh, it's not a static definition. It's not a, you know, it's not, we're not, our feet aren't in concrete on this. The Obama administration has refused for the first time to declare that Pakistan is making progress toward ending alleged military support for Islamic militant groups or preventing Al-Qaeda, the Afghan Taliban, or other extremists from staging attacks in Afghanistan. We're not going to certify that this year. Even so, Secretary of State Clinton has quietly informed Congress that she's waived the legal restrictions that would have blocked some $2 billion in U.S. economic and military aid to Pakistan. So it's okay. You can not be certifiable as having cut your links with the Haqqani network and Al-Qaeda, and you can still get the $2 billion. Congratulations, guys. I think you won. And now, ladies and gentlemen, catching up on something. It was a couple weeks ago where it was announced that Jimmy Kimmel Live, the ABC late night chat show, as they say in England, talk show, as we say in the United States, whatever it is, Jimmy Kimmel Live would be moving to from its 12:05 a.m. time slot to 11:35 p.m. Eastern and Pacific times, 1 hour earlier in the Central time zone, of course, to compete on an even playing field for the first time with Jay and Dave. And what this meant was that Nightline was kind of going to go bye-bye. Oh, they'd have a primetime hour every once in a while on a Friday night if you weren't watching. But it basically was sort of the end of the line, even though Nightline has been kind of beating the talk shows and the ratings. But, you know, they can make more money, I guess, with Jimmy's show than with Nightline, because it's the old duffers who watch Nightline, isn't it? And it just reminded me of, you know, it all could have turned out so differently for that storied show.
From the Rune Arledge Theater in New York City, where none of the anchors has barnacles, this is Late Night Line with Ted Koppel. Tonight, newsman Aaron Brown, former National Security Advisor Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski, and Paul Schaefer, and the ABC News Symphony. Man who's more serious than his hair, Ted Koppel.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome to this new incarnation of Nightline. This program started out as America Held Hostage. It's ending up as Ted Koppel held hostage. No, I kid the good people at ABC, but we are in this beautifully refurbished theater, and we're going to have a very good time getting to the bottom of today's news. Paul, how...
Yes,
Paul
sir.
Schaefer, how are you, sir?
Ted, I am fine. I'm glad to be on ABC. I've now been on every network in the United States and Canada, except for Global.
Well, Global?
Yeah, it's a Canadian thing. Yeah. It's a swinging little syndication setup.
Paul Schaefer, you are totally steeped in show business.
Well, Ted, let me just say, for my daughter's bat mitzvah,
yes,
we are building a green room in the temple, because...
But, Paul, yeah, do you follow the news at all?
I love the news.
You do?
I love the news.
And then I have the feeling I'm being set up for something here.
No, they don't write for me on this show either.
Well, that at least is reassuring. Our first guest tonight is a one-time, sometime occupant of this chair. He was a longtime anchor of his own broadcast over at CNN, where he enjoyed great success until his enjoyment was brought to an end. Please welcome my friend, Mr. Aaron Brown. Aaron, sir, thank you for venturing back into a television studio to visit with us.
Ted, it is so difficult for me to believe how this show has changed. There are
colognes on the dressing room toilet.
There are indeed, and there's Irish coffee at the snack table.
Yes, it is impossible to not notice that.
Aaron, like this broadcast, your CNN program was born in crisis, but yours seems to have been ended by a crisis as well, specifically Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. In its wake, you seem to have been left in the wake of a former colleague.
Well, that's right, Ted. And I also have to say that that's a perfectly written introductory sentence.
You are too kind.
And that former colleague, Anderson Cooper, was like a younger brother to me. But in a broadcast sense, he was the heart and I was the brains. And I think in our brief time together, we made up almost an entire human personality.
Well, Aaron, you are no slouch yourself when it comes to writing your ad libs. But even before the disaster, you were losing viewers to your competition on Fox, the suddenly monominous Greta. Thank you.
This sounds like an audience that would appreciate onomatopoeia. But yes, Ted, that is correct. And in fact, as I look forward to new opportunities to practice a more leisurely, thoughtful approach to television news, my agent and I felt that we need to meet the competition head on. So yesterday afternoon I had, and this is very awkward for me to say this, I had some eye work done.
You did.
I did. I brought a before picture for you.
This is unreal.
And well, Ted, this is the most interesting part of the story. We videotaped the surgery, and it's on my demo reel as a 6-part deeper look segment.
Oh,
thank you.
Yeah. Now, again, Aaron, we do speak as old friends, and this is a question that did come up frequently in the Van Susteren case. Are you sure it was only eye work?
Because I swear to you, Ted, nothing but a minor tune-up around the corners of my eyes.
Well, but to tell you the truth, Aaron, something's different around the mouth, too, isn't it?
Well, I don't know, Ted. Maybe it's just the accumulated strain from saying a headline please a half dozen times a night for the past 4 years.
Well, that did become your trademark phrase, didn't it, before the network made you drop it? Favor us with it one more time, if you would.
All right. Ted Koppel, a headline, please. Thank you.
All right. What's the prognosis, Aaron? Are you going to have more of this type of surgery?
Ted, I seriously hope not. I pray that this was an aberration and not the start of a process.
They say it can become addictive.
Only to management. Seriously, Ted, I prefer caffeine.
Well, Aaron, stay with us if you can. Our next guest is a most distinguished scholar and practitioner in the field of international relations. He was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor and a longtime friend of this broadcast. Please welcome Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski. Dr. Brzezinski, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Ted. First time in this circumstance, though.
I should explain. We're going to have a little fun with Dr. Brzezinski tonight. We will discuss some of the more intractable trouble spots in the world. As you can see, he's suspended over a large tank, which we happen to have filled with oatmeal in the first of what we're calling a series of stupid professor tricks.
3, 4. Stupid professor tricks. He's too smart to do those stupid professor tricks. Yeah.
It looks like very good oatmeal, Ted.
Well, at these prices, I should hope so. All right, Doctor, let's start out with a very difficult situation between India and Pakistan.
All right, Ted, India is a regional superpower. Pakistan is a problematic regional fulcrum-type nation.
And the war
between the Hindus and the Muslims.
Well, that's very well done, sir. I hope that isn't one of your good suits.
Well, it isn't anymore.
It certainly isn't. What about Central Africa, Dr. Mm-hmm. Brzezinski? Do we just have to wait for the Rwanda-Congo tribal conflict to burn itself out?
I don't think so, Ted, and let me tell you why. And the next thing you know, you've got another Robert Mugabe on your hands.
Or another Joseph Mobutu.
Well, I'm the one getting wet. Let me use my example.
All right, fair enough. And finally, because we are running out of both time and oatmeal, give us a roadmap, if you can, of how we get from where we are now to peace in the Middle East.
Ted, the key is the Iranians. The Saudis are trying to steal a march on them at the moment. Into a bona fide peace process.
Dr. Brzezinski, thank you so much for participating in our first Stupid Professor Trick.
It was my pleasure, Ted.
Stupid Professor Tricks, yeah!
Thank you, Paul. And the transcript of Dr. Brzezinski's full comments will be on our website, so you can actually find out what's on his mind. What's on my mind is thanks to Aaron Brown, Dr. Brzezinski, and, of course, our own Paul Schaefer.
Yeah, thank you, Ted.
For helping me through this first broadcast. You know, change is never easy. We do hope to find this a more comfortable fit as time goes on. Tomorrow night, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the Centers of Disease Control and our list of the top 10 pedophile priests. That's our broadcast for this evening. Good night.
This has been ABC News Late Nightline. For a video recording of this program, call a friend who has TiVo. More people get their news from ABC News than is good for a healthy democracy. Good night.
And now, ladies and gentlemen,
clean, safe, too cheap to me.
Can't go through the whole litany. We don't have enough time, and we don't have enough time for Addie.
Yeah.
The utility that runs California's troubled San Onofre nuclear plant is in the midst of unprecedented upheaval as it works to try to get its one of its two reactors up. Now come internal documents, one report, one company-wide survey, and a series of management emails revealing in the past few months the owner, Southern California Edison, has a few problems. It's firing a lot of folks, but apparently, according to the latest survey only of its employees, only 39% of its workers agree that Edison rewards people who follow its ethics and compliance standards. Only 54% say they could question management's decisions without fear of retaliation. 38% said Edison does not reward questionable actions, compared to a 61% in a national survey that asked a similar question. Says Carlene Roberts, an expert in workplace culture at UC Berkeley, about this survey: those numbers are bad. That company's in trouble. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission said Thursday it has placed the Sheeran-Harris nuclear power plant in southeast Wake County, North Carolina, under increased oversight because of internal safety violations linked to the operation of ventilation systems for facilities at the plant that would be staffed during emergencies. Officials said there was no immediate safety concern because no emergencies had happened. That's a relief. Hundreds of defects have been found throughout Europe's nuclear reactors, and mostly in France, according to a European Union stress test report leaked the German and French media. So be lucky you don't live in Europe. Be grateful. Duke Energy's Oconee nuclear plant in South Carolina faces more flood risk from an upstream dam than earlier estimated, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Workers at Nine Point Nuclear Station Unit 1 in upstate New York have yet to determine the source of the tritium leak discovered in August at the plant. The tritium-laced water is leaking into the plant. That's a new one. And the Department of Energy is not doing enough to prevent a buildup of flammable gases in radioactive waste tanks at the facility that's trying to clean up the former nuclear weapons production center at Hanford. This is according to the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board. A significant flammable gas accident would have considerable radiological consequences, endanger personnel, contaminate portions of the tank farms, and seriously disrupt the waste cleanup mission, said the Defense Board. It calls on the Department of Energy to work faster to upgrade the ventilation to ensure removal of flammable gases from the space in the double shell tanks. You're welcome. Clean, safe, true, cheap to meter, our friend, the atom. Addy had a cold anyway.
I just had an infected neutrino.
All right. Gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. With congratulations to the Metropolitan Police in London for finding that stolen iPad within an hour. The program returns next week at the same time over the same station, not mine. Oh, the same stations on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, on NPR worldwide throughout Europe, around the world through facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCU, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like finding the source of that tritium leak if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. The highly offensive song Deaf Boys is featured on my new record, Can't Take a Hint. It actually can be bought. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Hawaii, and Chicago desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead and to Adrian Bodnam, Bodders, here at Global Radio in London. This crazy thing called Global Radio for help with today's broadcast. This broadcast is represented on Twitter. Join the almost 72,000 flowers or followers at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the Rubber Promise and the home of the homeless. So long from London.